welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Friday, October 29th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. On the front page, we have a University of Iowa story reported by Vanessa Miller. More UI Children's Hospital windows need safety film. UIHC already spending over $10 million in fixing faulty windows in tower. The University of Iowa has identified 77 more windows in its Stead Family Children's Hospital that need an emergency safety film, costing another $771,516 to keep from cracking or posting safety risks. UI Healthcare this week revealed the discovery of additional damaged windows in its 4-year-old, 14-story children's hospital when it asked the State Board of Regents to approve emergency authorization of a contract with Marv's Glass to apply more safety film. Typically, the board must put out for public bid those projects expected to top $100,000 unless, quote, a delay in undertaking a repair, restoration, or reconstruction of a public improvement might cause serious loss or injury, unquote, according to a portion of Iowa code that UIHC cited in its request. The new UIHC request, which the board is scheduled to consider next week, comes after the university received approval in April to spend $10 million to $15 million replacing 2 floors worth of delaminated or cracking windows, discovered in July 2019, just 2 years after the facility opened. At the time of the proposal in April, UIHC reported it had installed, quote, a protective film on all windows that have been identified as potential safety hazards to provide an additional margin of safety, unquote. At the time, UIHC said it would actively monitor all windows while a permanent solution is determined. And UI Senior Vice President of Finance and Operations, Rod Leonards, told Regents the hospital might discover more problem windows. Leonards said in April, adding, the work that we're doing is wider than just the windows that are impacted. We will continue to monitor and investigate any other occurrences, but it is not just the windows that are visibly damaged, but rather more widespread. Regents spokesman Josh Lehman confirmed for the Gazette this week that the 77 Williams windows identified as needing a safety film requiring the emergency authorization are in addition to windows on floors 4 and 5 that UIHC in the spring said needed replacing. Although the university hasn't yet received that emergency authorization, it reported in Regent documents that installation started in October 2021. UIHC declined to answer the Gazette's questions about where the $10 million to $15 million window replacement project stands now. If the 77 additional windows are on different floors than those originally identified, how much UIHC has spent on the replacement so far, and whether it has an overall timeline. In April, the university reported it was looking into possible causes, including manufacturer and installation questions, Leonard said UI intends to hold responsible the causing parties. But officials didn't answer questions this week about pursuing insurance or warranty coverage. As part of its commitment to a safe, high-quality care environment, University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics proactively performs regular monitoring and maintenance of its facilities, UIHC officials said in a statement. This monitoring identified an issue in the performance of some windows. UIHC immediately took steps to install protective film, conduct expanded monitoring of the windows, and replace windows as needed. The Gazette reported in April that UIHC had paid a consultant nearly $1 million to assess the damage and offer solutions. It also, at that time, already had paid Marv's Glass of Iowa City $577,751 to install film. Those costs, officials said, were included in the $10 million to $15 million replacement project, which pushed an already ballooning children's hospital budget to $407 million, $137 million over its original $270 million budget. The article is accompanied by a front page picture of the circular or oval shaped hospital as it's seen from the ground up. On the Iowa Today page, excluded workers seek more pandemic money. $2 million isn't enough, they say. This is reported from Iowa City by Isabella Zaluska. The Fund Excluded Workers Coalition again urged the Johnson County Board of Supervisors to significantly increase pandemic relief funds for undocumented workers. More than 100 immigrant workers rallied Wednesday ahead of the county's final public input session on how the federal dollars should be spent, chanting, "Si, puede," yes, we can, and holding signs and messages, "No more stalling, we need relief now." Johnson County is getting $29.3 million in federal American Rescue Plan Act funds and has indicated support for $2 million in payments to individuals who were excluded from federal stimulus checks. But the coalition says that's not enough. For more than 6 months, the group has been urging the county and other local governments allocate more money, quote, directly to the people, unquote. The group is asking for $54 million, an estimate of all federal pandemic relief money going to Johnson County governments, to go to undocumented immigrants, previously incarcerated people, and unemployed workers. Of those funds, the coalition is asking for $20 million in direct cash assistance for up to 6,000 excluded workers. They also want governments to put rescue plan money toward hazard pay for low-wage essential workers and for affordable housing and public transportation. Ninoska Campos, with the Fund Excluded Workers Coalition, advocated for these demands during the public input session. Campos said through interpreter Emily Sinwell, $2 million is not enough for each excluded worker and family to receive the support they should receive. We don't come with force, but we come to be clear and to ask you to listen. This is time for help and the people who put their lives at risk during the pandemic. The time is now. Katie Beichler, an organizer with the Local Service Employees International Union, said the funds need to be distributed directly to the people and can't have restrictions on or paperwork that will deter people from accessing the funds. Campos and Beichler were among the 20-plus individuals who spoke during the meeting held at the county's Health and Human Services building in Iowa City. Chairs were set up for about 50 people, with others asked to watch the two-hour input session in the hallway, though they were allowed to come into the room to speak. Rose Schroeder, a senior urban planner at Bolton and Menck, presented public input collected from county residents between May and October on how people want to see the pandemic funds used. The county also held 6 in-person public input sessions with additional input from an online survey, questionnaires, and comment cards. 6 themes emerged, Schroeder said, including enhanced and expanded broadband premium pay for essential workers. I'm sorry, let's show that again. Enhanced and expanded broadband premium pay for essential workers, direct assistance to households, and helping small businesses. Respondents also indicated support for investing in affordable housing, child care, and food access. Residents indicated they want funding to provide long-term, lasting impact in the county. David Goodner, co-founder of the Catholic Worker House, criticized the report and how it did not include the words immigrant, excluded worker, and stimulus check that have come up throughout the public input process. Your report doesn't even have their voices included in it, Goodner said. During a Wednesday morning work session, Johnson County supervisors continued to work through about 60 potential projects, totaling more than $50 million for the ARPA funds. Donna Brooks, the Johnson County's grants coordinator, said few local governments have awarded direct aid to residents yet, though St. Louis has. There are discussions with the county attorney's office of how to create this program properly without putting undocumented individuals at risk, Brooks said. Brooks said the attorney's office is concerned that the county arrive at the $3,200 figure for excluded workers by adding up the three federal stimulus checks sent to Americans, because the stimulus checks are, quote, considered a stream of payments, unquote. Brooks said the office is concerned about, quote, putting the people that we provide that money to in jeopardy because it could affect their ability to seek citizenship status in the future, unquote, due to rules from the Trump administration regarding stream of payments to non-citizens. The board has an ARPA work session scheduled for November 8 and a joint work session with the Iowa City Council on November 16. A final report from Bolton and Menk is to be presented to the board November 18, when the board could vote to approve some of the first ARPA projects. The article is accompanied by a picture of several of the protesters and excluded workers as they sit Wednesday during Johnson County's final input session on how to use the federal pandemic funds. One of the persons sitting down and holding a child, all of them masked, is holding a yellow sign that says, Fund Excluded Workers. And still on the Iowa Today page, a related story, Marion looking for input on how to spend federal aid. City will get about $6 million in pandemic relief funds, reported by Gage Miskeman of the Gazette. The City of Marion has launched an online survey to ask residents how the city should use American Rescue Plan Act dollars. The survey, available now, will be open through November 24 on the city's website. The funds are intended to help the community respond to the COVID-19 pandemic and lay the foundation for a strong and equitable recovery, Assistant to the City Manager Amal El-Tahir said. Community input will help inform the city's budget process and effective distribution of these funds. The city has already identified five possible uses for the building in Marion, for the funding in Marion, but is looking for feedback from community members on how best to spend the money. The city will receive a little more than $6 million in ARPA funding over the next 2 years. The American Rescue Plan Act, passed earlier this year by Congress, is a $1.9 trillion economic stimulus bill meant to speed up the U.S. economic and health recovery from the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The five potential city uses that fall in line with the rules of ARPA are sanitary sewer upgrades and improvements, housing assistance for qualified homeowners or renters, transit service improvements, water infrastructure, and nonprofit and impacted industry assistance programs. Earlier this week, Linn County and the City of Cedar Rapids launched an online request for proposals process at cr-linarpa.org for organizations, including other city governments, to apply for a share of federal ARPA funds. The deadline to apply is January 7. The first round of funding will be a combined $14 million, with $11 million coming from the county and $3 million from Cedar Rapids. Overall, the county will receive $44 million in ARPA funds, and Cedar Rapids will get its own $28 million in total. Al-Tahir said the city intends to apply for Linn County funds as well, but the city doesn't have a program ready to go yet, as it's currently in the process of getting community input. For example, we are discussing housing assistance programs with East Central Iowa Council of Governments as a partner in implementation, she said. The goal is to leverage other dollars and capitalize on partnerships to maximize the impact. And still on the Iowa Today page, we have Gage Meskimen of the Gazette reporting developer delays Transamerica plan. Plat was pulled from Cedar Rapids Planning Commission agenda. Hunter Companies has withdrawn its preliminary subdivision plat for the former Transamerica site, saying it wants to gather more neighborhood input. We would like the opportunity to address the neighborhood's concerns with development before proceeding with the subdivision of the site, Shannon Thompson, general counsel for the developer, said. Plans for the 51-acre site on Edgewood Road Northeast had been scheduled to come before the City Planning Commission on Thursday afternoon. Hunter Companies is buying the land from Transamerica and pursuing a mixed-use development there. The land at 4333 Edgewood Road Northeast was put up for sale in March along with Transamerica's former offices at 4425 and 4415 North River Boulevard Northeast as part of the company's consolidation of office space. Neighbors created a Facebook group, 42nd and Edgewood, /Save Our Neighborhood, to make their concerns known. It had 129 members as of Thursday afternoon. Organizer Dave Watson said he thinks Hunter is a great option to develop the property, but he wants the developer to work with the neighborhood. The list of concerns include saving trees, retaining retention ponds, providing green space, and increased traffic. Watson said Hunter's decision to delay its preliminary plat gives the neighborhood hope. He said, "I really hope it can be a win-win situation. We're hoping they want our input. They say they do. I hope Hunter is thinking about what their legacy will be in Cedar Rapids. They've already built great commercials, but this is a first one that will tie into multiple neighborhoods. It's a big deal, and it's going to be a huge change." Hunter Companies has experience with other mixed-use developments in Cedar Rapids. The company developed the Northtown Market site across the street from Target on Blairs Ferry Road Northeast, the Berthel Fisher Financial Center, and Edgewood Station and Edgewood Market on Edgewood Road Southwest near Westdale Mall. The article is accompanied by a picture of Jennifer Newman of Cedar Rapids speaking with others Thursday at the City Planning Commission meeting in Cedar Rapids City Hall. The picture was taken by Jeff Stelfox of the Gazette. And now it's time for us to turn to the Insight page for today's Gazette editorial, and it's headlined, "Dueling Ads Won't Do It." Three red Midwestern states have and are spending a total of $18.7 million in federal pandemic relief funds on ad campaigns touting their states to tourists and potential workers. "We can't help but wonder if this is truly a productive way to address a shortage of workers or to spend relief dollars." Nebraska became the latest state, announcing a $10 million campaign to lure workers titled "The Good Life is Calling," playing on the state motto. The ad will run in a 500-mile radius around Nebraska, including Chicago, Denver, Kansas City, and Minneapolis, as well as in Austin, Texas, and Silicon Valley. Last fall, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem announced a $5 million campaign prominently featuring her along with Buffalo and Mount Rushmore. In September, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds unveiled a $3.7 million campaign, including a 30-second ad to be run in the Midwest and on national cable networks. It's part of the This Is Iowa marketing effort. In the ad, there's a sailboat on a lake, among several images of people enjoying outdoor recreation. The Des Moines skyline is featured, as are Arnold's Park and Sioux City's amphitheater. The ad touts, quote, rolling hills and low bills, unquote. So when you are coming to see, when are you coming to see us? The ad asks. Another question, so when are we going to get creative? All three ads tout outdoor recreation, feature children, and pitch very similar attributes. Iowa's low bills are matched by the Nebraska ad featuring a very nice $225,000 home. Credit to Reynolds in Nebraska, Governor Pete Ricketts, for not appearing in the ad. Nome, an ambitious GOP rising star, couldn't resist making it look like a campaign appeal. We show pretty pictures of outdoor destinations, but woefully underfund our state park system and have taken precious little action to clean up our dirty waters. Children and young adults attend inadequately funded public schools and universities where tuition is rising. Students who attend our universities may be enticed to stay. We show cities as the GOP legislature strips them of governing authority. So instead of making real investments in our attributes we pitch, we simply trade glossy, hollow claims with our neighbors. If people thinking of moving here do simple homework, the gloss quickly will fade. With the state sitting on a massive budget surplus, it's time to make those investments and get Iowa ready for its close-up. That's the Gazette editorial on the Insight page today. And we have a guest, an editorial fellow written by Althea Cole, and it's titled Dark Money in a Local Race. If you've grown weary of the bitter partisanship that has clouded the Cedar Rapids mayoral race, brace yourself for more ugliness. We've reached the dark money phase of the contest. Saturday, I received a campaign mailer to add to the stack. Like those previously sent by the Amara Andrews campaign, it reminds voters of candidate Tiffany O'Donnell's registration as one of those evil Republicans, apparently a crucial factor in this nonpartisan race. This mailer was not sent by Andrews' campaign. Sure, it used the exact same photo of O'Donnell as Andrews' literature and was printed in the same font. Yes, it's used the same phrasing to connect O'Donnell with other Republicans such as U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson and Governor Kim Reynolds. Notably, O'Donnell donated to Reynolds' challenger, Fred Hubble, during the last gubernatorial election. Even the attribution statement required by Iowa law to be displayed on political material to identify who paid for it was placed in the same spot where Andrews' campaign literature listed its own. But the attribution itself was the key difference. The mailer I received Saturday read, "Paid for by Iowa Voter Info." What or who is Iowa Voter Info? I have no idea. There's no committee listed on the website for the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board with a name resembling anything even close to Iowa Voter Info. There's also nothing on the FEC website. A Facebook page called Iowa Voter Information was emphatically confirmed by its administrator, a resident of Keokuk, to be unaffiliated with the name on the mailer. Google searches for Iowa Voter Info and Iowa Voter Info PAC yield all sorts of results, as one might imagine with such generic search terms. But they don't produce any websites about any group campaigning on a specific issue or candidate, in stark contrast to other committees hoping to influence local voters. For example, a search for Level Up for Marion leads to a Facebook page for a committee of the same name, formed to encourage passage of a bond referendum for the Marion Independent School District. Per Iowa law, it filed a statement of organization with the Ethics Board so voters can see who is funding it. Andrews, her campaign chairman Steve Shriver, and Linn County Supervisor Stacy Walker, who is advising her campaign through his consulting firm, all indicated they are unfamiliar with the origin of the mailer. Andrews said in a text message Monday, "I don't know what Iowa voter info means." But in campaign finance documents released Thursday, the Andrews campaign reported giving $9,000 to Iowa voter info this month, one of the campaign's largest expenditures. The campaign also received an in-kind donation from the group totaling more than $7,500 for direct mail. Unfortunately, voters also know nothing about Iowa voter info. They don't know the identities of the involved people, nor their values, principles, or what motivates their involvement in our mayoral race. Worst of all, voters know nothing about the organization's finances and are oblivious to the origins of substantial funds needed to produce a professional mailer for voters. I wish it were different. Much has been made about the partisan tone of the Cedar Rapids mayoral race. Dark money only fuels that cynicism. I long for the days when municipal elections really were just about potholes and speed cameras. That was the editorial fellow item submitted by Althea Cole, who is an editorial fellow of the Gazette. And we have one community letter submitted by Eric Gutschmidt of Cedar Rapids. Marcus understands the needs of core neighborhoods. In March 2020, I proposed building a modest duplex in Wellington Heights. It would have been the first new construction project in the neighborhood since 1970 that did not ask for any subsidy from the city or any other grants, and it would have been affordable for people making 60% to 80% of the median income. At the city council meeting, Dale Todd condemned the project and said that the neighborhood was too fragile for this project, and so today, that lot sits empty as a missing tooth in a neighborhood trying to revitalize itself. In comparison, Tamara Marcus has a different style. She is a scientist by profession, and she seeks to gather data and talk to people and build consensus. She has knocked doors in Wellington Heights and Oak Hill, Jackson, and Taylor, and she understands that the core neighbors are struggling but are worth investing in. In a recent Gazette survey, affordable housing was named as a top concern in Cedar Rapids, and that concern cannot be addressed without the core neighborhoods being a big part of the conversation. This is why I'm supporting her to be our next council member representing District 3. She is from Cedar Rapids and has what it takes to lead on issues of affordable housing and equity. And that was the single letter submitted today by Eric Gutschmidt of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for this Friday, October 29th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituary. First, we take a look at our other and shorter notices. We have three of those. From Cedar Rapids, Daryl J. Nye, 77, died Tuesday, October 26th. The Phillips Funeral Home, Vinton, is handling arrangements for the family of Daryl J. Nye. From Maquoketa, Barbara Ann Dague, D-A-G-U-E, 80, died Wednesday, October 27. Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. And from Swisher, Martha Zach, 98, died Thursday, October 28th. The Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center, Cedar Rapids, is handling arrangements for Martha Zach of Swisher. Now for our regular and longer notices. We have from Cedar Rapids, Catherine Louise Klenk, 95, passed away on October 27 at Northbrook Manor Care Center, Cedar Rapids. Memorial service, 11 a.m., Tuesday, November 2nd, at Robic Newhouse Funeral Service, Belle Plaine. visitation 1 hour prior to the service. Mary Wieda and Kara Plesek will be officiating. The burial will take place at Rector Cemetery, Chelsea. Memorials may be directed to the family of Catherine Louise Klenk of Cedar Rapids, and online condolences can be sent to the family at the newhousefuneralservice.com website. From Cedar Rapids, Jote Lou Lotai passed away peacefully with family by her side after a short battle with cancer on October 23rd in Cedar Rapids at the age of 87 years. Funeral services will be held at noon Saturday, October 30, at Tehan Funeral Home. Jot will be laid to rest with her sons at Glendale Cemetery in the Thai Dom section in Des Moines. Online condolences for Jot Lou Lotai of Cedar Rapids may be left for the family at tehanfuneralhome.com. From Cedar Rapids, Ruth Lee Yorger Streed, 103, died Tuesday, October 26, at St. Luke's Hospital, Cedar Rapids. Celebration of life will be held 2 p.m. Saturday, November 6, at Murdoch-Linwood Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. You may share a memory of Ruth Lee Yorger Streed at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. From Olwine, Richard Lutz, 79, passed away at his home on Sunday, October 24th. Private services will be held for the family, with burial taking place at Green Center Cemetery in Morley. You may visit thegetchonline.com and share your thoughts, memories, and stories and condolences with the family. Cards may be addressed to the family at the Getch Funeral Home, Anamosa. That's for Richard Lutz of Olwine. From Liberty, Missouri, Cade Blackford, 24, formerly of Marion, passed away October 26th. Family will greet friends 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, November 3rd at Antioch Christian Church, Marion. The funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 4th at the church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made in Cade Blackford's memory and directed to the family to be designated at a later date. You may share a memory of Cade at murdochfuneralhome.com under obituaries. From Northport, Florida, Michael Allen Adair. He was born in Cedar Rapids, and he passed away unexpectedly at home October 24th after a bout with cancer at the age of 62 at his home in Northport, Florida. Celebration of life, 2 to 5 p.m. November 6th at Long Branch Hotel and Convention Center, Twixtown Road, Cedar Rapids. And that's 2 to 6 p.m. November 6th for Michael Allen Adair of Northport, Florida. From Tipton, Margaret Marge Leona Ellis, 93, and formerly of Cedar Rapids and Tipton, died peacefully on Wednesday while under the care of the Clarence Nursing Home. Visitation and funeral services Saturday, October 30, starting at 2 p.m. for the visitation and service at 3 p.m. at Fry Funeral Home, Tipton, the Reverend Ron Lashmit officiating. Cremation will follow, and interment remains will be at a future date in the Tipton Masonic Cemetery. Online condolences for Margaret Marge Leona Ellis may be left at the website fryfuneralhome.com. From Bullhead City, Arizona, Thomas James Michael, who was born in Walker, Iowa. Thomas James Michael died at 78 and in a hospital in Oregon on October 6th. He had joined the U.S. Navy, and there are no further indications of arrangements for a funeral. That would be for Thomas James Michael, Bullhead City, Arizona. And finally, we have from Ballstone Lake, New York, Emily B. Stultz. She died at the age of 97 and died peacefully on October 22nd. Funeral service will be held privately at the convenience of the family. In view of flowers, donations may be made to the community hospice of Saratoga County. The family has placed their loving care, placed their trust and loving care with the Townley and Wheeler Funeral Home in Ballston Lake, New York. They encourage you to view Emily's Book of Memories at the website Townley, T-O-W-N-L-E-Y, Wheeler Funeral Home, TownleyWheelerFH.com. That was for Emily B. Stultz of Ballstone Lake, who died at the age of 97. And that concludes the list of today's obituaries. And now we turn to the sports page for high school cross-country story, reported by Jeff Linder from Troy Mills. And the title is, Back to Healthy, Back to Running Fast. Recovered from a severe bout with ARFID, North Lynn's Wheatley among the best in Class 1A. The scale is back in the closet. Once the source of so much anxiety, it no longer is necessary. Megan Wheatley has regained her weight, her muscle, her life. Everybody goes through stuff in their life, said her father, Brian Wheatley. Families go through hard times. This was our turn. A 15-year-old sophomore at North Lynn, Megan will compete at the state cross-country championships this weekend at Lakeside Golf Course near Fort Dodge. She'll be among more than 100 competitors in the Class 1A girls race, scheduled to begin at 2:30 Saturday afternoon. A good race could land her in the top 10. Just making it to the starting line, that's an achievement. This time last year, Megan was sliding down a physical and emotional spiral. Preliminarily diagnosed with anorexia, the correct terminology was avoidance restrictive food intake disorder. I thought if she came out of it, she would be a stronger person, said her mother, Melissa Wheatley. We just weren't sure she'd come out of it. But what was it? Unlike anorexia, ARFID does not include having a distorted body image or being preoccupied with body image. The root cause of Megan's bout began last October when she began to complain of digestive issues, or to be more blunt, as Megan said, I couldn't poop. Another trigger was how her freshman cross-country season ended prematurely. Shortly before the 2020 Tri-Rivers Conference meet, a member of North Lynn's team tested positive for COVID-19. As a result, the entire team was placed under quarantine for 14 days. No conference meet, no regional meet, no state meet, season over. Megan was very sad, North Lynn cross-country coach Bob Mudd said. She cried and cried. Then stomach issues took her further and she spiraled downhill. Because of her gastrointestinal issues, Megan didn't feel hungry, so she ate sparingly, only from a suggested foods list given to her by a specialist. I just told myself I wasn't hungry, she said. Her first medical visit was in late October. As fall turned into winter, visits became more frequent and more frantic. Brian and Melissa both are teachers at North Lynn. Other staff members and other parents would mention that Megan seemed distant or just off. I was emailed by the teacher and visited by another commenting on her lack of involvement and difference in demeanor, Melissa said. Megan was an active, bubbly, outgoing, social, and intelligent student, but things had begun to change. Through December and January, according to Melissa, Megan's attitude and demeanor worsened. She couldn't reason. She had difficulty putting together thoughts, Melissa said. Her body was in survival mode, using any nutrition to power the larger organs and taking it away from other parts of her body. Megan was weak, tired, sluggish. Nobody was aware of her weight loss because winter was sweatshirt and sweatpants season and because the family didn't own a scale. I noticed when she was sitting next to Brian and she looked very skeletal in her basketball uniform, Melissa said. The Wheatleys noted a few people that were invaluable in Megan's journey. One was Sarah Neff, a pediatric nurse practitioner from Cedar Rapids. She was divine intervention that we met Sarah that day, Melissa said. I couldn't have asked for somebody better on our team. Another one was Ellen Reese Davis, the former Northland track star and now a dietitian specializing in athletes' nutritional programming. Megan's first Zoom meeting with Davis didn't go well. Megan said little and made no eye contact, but Davis stuck with her. Meanwhile, Megan's weight continued to slide. At 5'2" or so, she weighed 95 pounds during cross-country season. At her low mark on March 9, she was down to 72. Her BMI had dropped below the chart, and she was in danger of significant health issues. That was the day she was admitted by Neff to the pediatric ward of Mercy Medical Center. That's where she stayed for 2 weeks, closely monitored, and that's where the turnaround began. She was discharged back up to 86 pounds March 23rd. No activity was permitted, and daily weight checks were reported. The daily nutrition log required 3 meals, 3 snacks, and 3 protein drinks. By May, she returned to school. So what triggered Megan's recovery? Weightlifting, she said. You can't build muscle without food, and that helped get my appetite back. By mid-June, cardio was reintroduced in 30-minute segments as part of a 10-week return-to-run program by physical therapist Kapos Physical Therapy. Kapos. First, it was run a minute, walk 5 minutes, then run 2 minutes, walk 4, and so forth. The goal in Megan's mind was to return to cross-country season, and when camp began in early August, she was ready. I didn't care what anybody else said. I was going to run, she said. Today, Megan is nearly 5'3 and weighed more than 100 pounds before the scale got put away for good. She does a lot of cooking in the house. I love making salmon, brown rice, and sautéed vegetables, she said. And she's in the best running shape of her life. At last week's 1A regional meet in Iowa City, she finished in 19 minutes 51 seconds, winning by more than a minute. If you didn't know what happened to her, you'd never suspect anything, Mudd said. She's back to old Megan. She's talented and she's gritty beyond imagination. She's a ferocious competitor. You watch her run and you can see that she's outworking everybody by the way she's breathing. In an interview Monday, Megan wore a necklace with an infinity symbol. To me, there are no limits on what you can do and what you can endure. You know, I'm glad that this happened, she said. Why? It helped me realize how many people are in my corner, she said. It helped me because become a better runner, how to monitor my body, make sure I'm eating the right amount of food. At 2:30 Saturday afternoon, the gun will go off and more than 100 girls will sprint away from the starting line. All have unique stories. Megan Wheatley has hers. As for a goal, she didn't mention a time or a place. Instead, I want to leave the race knowing I couldn't have done better. She said, I want to say I couldn't have tried harder, that I left it all out there. The article is accompanied by a large color front page picture of the sport page of Megan smiling in her All-State sweatshirt and jacket, and also a color picture of her in the front of the pack of the group running cross country at a previous meet. We have a high school football story reported by K.J. Pilcher from Cedar Rapids. No praise, no problem for fullback. Kennedy's Flanagan embraces role to help team success. Colin Flanagan's name isn't going to litter a box score, and statistics aren't astounding. He's doesn't garner a lot of attention except from his coaches, teammates, whose production is boosted by his effort and maybe the opposition trying to limit his impact. Flanagan is content with his role as the unheralded fullback for Cedar Rapids Kennedy's offense, leading the way for others to rack up yards and touchdowns. Flanagan said, "At the end of the day, I like winning. As long as someone scores, I don't care about the name on the back of the jersey. I just care about whether they're wearing green and gold. Just like to contribute how I can." Flanagan played a key role in the top-ranked Cougars' unbeaten regular season. Expect him to make an impact when Kennedy hosts Dubuque Senior in a Class 5A first-round playoff game tonight at Kingston Stadium. "It's been exciting because I've never experienced an undefeated season," Flanagan said. The 6-foot-190-pounder is a rare breed of player. With a switch to glitzier spread offensive schemes, fullbacks have faded. Not every team needs one. The Cougars have the luxury of a selfless player, willing to do the dirty work without the acknowledgement. "He doesn't really get to touch the ball," Kennedy coach Brian White said. "He's a glorified offensive lineman. There aren't too many fullbacks left. He's a true old-school fullback. A tough position demands a tough person." Flanagan earned second-team All-Metro and All-Mississippi Valley Conference honors last season. He is also a state qualifier in wrestling, which translates well to the gridiron. "He's a good egg," White said. "He is a kid that will battle. He's a tough, hard-nosed kid that understands things like leverage and angles. That makes him pretty good at what he does." Kennedy ranks 7th in 5A with 3,803 all-purpose yards. Jason Williams leads the team with 893 rushing yards and 10 TDs. Quarterback Carson Blights has 1,519 passing yards and 17 scores. Flanagan has made an impact doing his job. "There are times where he knows exactly why he's in there to block," White said. His mother, Heather Jurgensen, instilled an unselfish mentality. "Since I was young, she made sure that we were looking out for others," Flanagan said. "Find the joy in what you are doing, even if what you're doing doesn't get the attention or all the praise. What you do matters. Do what you can to help others." The ball has been placed in his hands a few times. He has 14 touches this season, including 12 carries for 61 yards and a 6-yard TD. "Every time I touch the ball, especially in practice, I make sure to make a deal of it," Flanagan said with a laugh. The article is accompanied by a black and white picture of Flanagan and a teammate, Jason Williams, bumping face masks as they face each other in a celebration of a touchdown or a great play in a Cougar football game. We return to the Iowa Today page for a story from the Associated Press, and it's from Piasta. "Piasta mayor resigns days before unopposed election." The mayor of Piasta in eastern Iowa has resigned just days ahead of an election in which he is the only candidate on the ballot. Mayor Jim Merton submitted a resignation letter to city officials Tuesday, citing, quote, "recent and unexpected changes in my life," unquote, that would keep him from serving, the Telegraph Herald reported. He did not go into further detail. Merton will appear on the ballot Tuesday for another 4-year term and was running unopposed. Council member and Mayor Pro Tem John Kraft will temporarily step into the mayoral role until there is a permanent solution. Merton was first elected in a special election in January 2020. Piasta is about 65 miles north of Davenport. And we have another item reported by Aaron Jordan on the Iowa Today page, two women charged with Marion assault. Two Cedar Rapids women are accused of breaking into a Marion apartment October 16 and using a metal pole to beat up a woman. Mackenzie Tamayo, 24, and Shakira Watkins, 24, both of Cedar Rapids, faced charges of first-degree burglary of a Class B felony punishable by up to 25 years in prison. They are accused of forcing entry into a Marion apartment October 16 and assaulting a woman with a metal pole and ripping hair from the woman's head, the Marion Police Department reported. Officers who went to the apartment noted the occupant had visible injuries consistent with her account of what happened. The woman also had photos of Watkins and Tamayo outside her apartment shortly before the incident, and officers found witnesses who corroborated the women's report. The article is accompanied by pictures of those two who had been mentioned. And we have a picture called Setting the Scene, and I'll read the caption. Crew members install the flooring Thursday for the upcoming state volleyball tournament starting next week at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse in Cedar Rapids. That is a caption for an overhead photo of a predominantly black floor with bright rose-red squares being placed onto the floor as probably the matting or the surface for the volleyball courts. And then we have another picture of close-up from ground level of two workers, Taylor Picard and Scott Picard, worked together to install flooring Thursday for the upcoming state volleyball tournament at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse in Cedar Rapids. And the photos have been taken by Savannah Blake of the Gazette. And finally, I'll read the top weather story by meteorologist Joe Winters. Beyond the weather. The weather pattern is trending cooler overall. Highs have fallen into the 50s with lows in the 30s and 40s. Early next week, for the start of November, lows dip into the 20s. Although clouds and rain have been a problem lately, clearing is expected. This should lead us to some nice beyond the weather views. In the northeast sky at night, locate the constellation Cassiopeia. It is the W-shaped constellation. The brightest star in this constellation is Shadar. Just below Cassiopeia is the constellation Perseus. Perseus is most often known for the July-August meteor shower. Happy stargazing. And just as briefly, the weather for tomorrow is expected to be partly cloudy with the wind from the northwest 5 to 10 miles per hour, the high of 57 and a low of 39. We have the normal temperature range for this date or time is 58 and 38. The record high for this date was 84 in 1937, and it was down to zero in 1925. And that about does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Friday, October 29th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Anytime. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. It may surprise you to know that the garbage that leaves your house will be preserved for centuries in a landfill. More than a dump, landfills are an engineered storage system. On the bottom, there's a thick plastic membrane and a layer of compacted clay to keep liquids from entering the groundwater. Above that, the fill area is divided into cells for each day's garbage. As trucks dump garbage into the cell, it's compacted to become as small as possible. At the end of the day, the cell is closed off with a layer of soil and perhaps another layer of plastic, making it water and airtight. Most garbage won't break down in this environment, though anaerobic bacteria will digest food and organic waste and produce methane, also known as natural gas, the same kind you burn in your stove. Because it's flammable, the methane has to be flared off, or it can be collected and sold for industrial use, or used to run electric generators at the landfill. America leads the world by a wide margin in garbage production, with more than 1,400 pounds per person per year. More than half of it ends up in landfills. And 65% of that is packaging: cardboard, paper, plastic, bottles, and cans, nearly all of which could have been recycled. On average, recycling costs about half as much as storing garbage in a landfill. So if you'd like to reduce your garbage footprint and your city's municipal waste cost, recycling is the way to go. I'm Scott Tinker, filling you with fun facts on Earth Date.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.